Hellcat.
Hello and welcome back to the Ink Drop. My name is Matthew McGevna, and this is the second installment of my little mini-series that I'm doing on John Gardner's book on moral fiction. If you haven't listened to the first episode, you're free to go back and listen to that one first, since I'm taking this on a chapter-by-chapter basis. So some of the information is going to be building, you know, as we get through each chapter. So there might be some things I reference from chapter one that you may not quite get or quite understand if you haven't listened to the first episode of this mini-series. So pause this and take a moment to go back. If not, I guess it's fine to listen out of sequence. This episode is going to be looking at chapter two of part one of the book, which is Premises on Art or Morality. So the book is on moral fiction by John Gardner. And part one is called Premises on Art and Morality. We're going to be looking at chapter two. As I said in the first installment, the first episode of this little series, I first read on moral fiction back when I was revising Little Beasts. And I was having a hard time finding the appropriate way out of the novel. What was the moral way to end the novel, to wrap the characters up, to get them moving forward beyond the last page, in a way that was morally satisfying. So I picked up on moral fiction as a way to think about what would feel like the right ending. Meaning, what would the ending say about life and about human experience? And I felt that I had done a pretty good job representing what is in the fictional world of Turnbull, but I still struggled with that question of what ought to be. That was the ultimate way. How was I going to end the novel? Because as Gardner talks about, you do want to end fiction with this greater question of what ought to be, ought things be the way they already are? That could be the other way to think about that question. But certainly my characters and the fictive world that I created in Little Beasts, there was an ought to be. And I was glad to find it, and this book helped me find it. So in chapter one, as we talk, Gardner insists that art has to be moral, right? He talks about that word moral, but what is morality, right? Okay, let's take it on the premise that art needs to be moral. What is morality? So he addresses right at the outset of the stumbling blocks that can come to this discussion, right? One of the biggest traps, one of the biggest obstacles to this discussion is the layman's understanding of the word moral. Most of us take it to mean some sort of religious code of conduct enshrined in ancient texts and scriptures, right? Whether it be the Holy Scriptures, the New Testament, or the Old Testament, or the Talmud, or the Quran. We take moral to be equivalent with religion, with the religious code of conduct. And as a culture, I don't think it's a galaxy brain thing to say that we have gotten away from that kind of prescriptive thinking. At least we have gotten away as a culture from referring to those old ancient texts for instructions on how to live. Well, some of us have. Depending on what side of the Roe v. Wade issue you're on, you might beg to differ. But I think as our culture, our art, our literature, our music, the cultural tastemakers, the creators in the world who are in the Western world do seem to, if not wholesale rejected religious instruction, at the very least marginalized religious instruction and religion's impact. So we have gotten away from that kind of prescriptive thinking about it, to the extent that most of us will reflexively recoil at the word moral, right? And John Gardner kind of knows this in the book, and he knew this even in 1977. right? Most of us are going to sort of bristle at that word moral, right? If you were in a writing workshop, if you're going to be honest with yourself, and I'm going to be honest with myself, in a writing workshop, and a fellow at the workshop read a short story I wrote and said, well, this strikes me as immoral, I would shake my head like, what do you mean? What are we talking about here? Because I carry it around with my religious understanding of that definition right now. Okay, good. Gardner knows this and he mentions this. So he talks about what moral fiction is. And he says, moral fiction is not the same thing as conservatives getting mad at a TV show because characters set one another on fire, right? So it's not the same thing as, you know, Rudy Giuliani trying to get Piss Christ removed from the Brooklyn Museum, right? That famous controversy when he was the mayor of New York City. It's not conservatives just getting mad at a television show or that woman from Illinois who went on that letter writing campaign against Married with Children. It's not that. That's not what he means by moral. What Gardner is after is that the overall total effect of the novel needs to be moral, meaning it affirms life as opposed to being cynical of it. Is really what he's getting at, right? The overall total effect, not just that one individual does something in the bedroom with another person in a book and, oh my God, we clutch our pearls and aren't we scandalized by this? And what if the children see it or the elderly, right? That's a different story. What we're talking about is what is the totality, or Gardner's talking about, what is the totality, the total effect, the moral meaning, right, of this work of fiction after we have finished reading it, right? Does it affirm life? Or is it cynical of life? And that's one of the questions that you have to factor in when you're thinking about the work's morality. Therefore, right, fiction can have all the murders in the world, all the fire settings it wants, so long as it's searching for and analyzing human values, says Gardner, right? Which is something that more fashionable, the nihilistic fiction of his time, and honestly some of the fiction of our time, doesn't quite do, right? The search for and an analysis of human values. We're talking about human beings, right? What unites all of us, regardless of our ethnicities and sexual orientation and socioeconomic status, things of that nature. What is the human, what is the stuff that binds us, right? And what are those values that we're searching for? So, right, nihilistic fiction, if you look at it from that standpoint, right, sets fires to characters absent of motivation or consequence or meaning. It's almost done as a slapstick comedy, right? They set fires to characters without any motivation or consequence, and so then that's where you start to see the immorality, at least in John Gardner's version, understanding of morality, factor into this question, right? It's not so much that they set the that a character sets another character on fire. It's that he sets them on fire for no real apparent reason, as we see in some fiction that takes place, right? Nor do we see that decision was a poor decision at any point in the fiction. When you close the book and you finish the novel, if that fire setting has not somehow been addressed, right, in some real consequential way that questions and affirms life and affirms life's values, then you might be starting. Then you're talking about more of the morality that Gardner is talking about, not the Judeo-Christian sense of immoral, because you saw a murder on the page, right? So it's not the specific act that you might see in the novel, right? Moral art tests those values and rouses trustworthy feelings about the better and worse parts of humanity. Right, I'm going to look at that again. Moral art tests these values and rouses trustworthy feelings about the better and worse parts of morality. Right, so yeah, okay, great. So there's something about that word trustworthy. Now, what is trustworthy about a fiction writer? Right, it is fiction after all. Mm. Well, it's a relationship. It requires trust, right? It's a relationship. A work of fiction enters into with the reader, right? A contract, if you will, that the writer enters into with the reader. Like any relationship, it's going to require trust, right? As the reader, are we going to trust the fiction writer? Are we going to trust the artist to take us where this fiction is taking us? The reader has to know that the writer knows what he's doing and where he's taking them, right? We have to trust that the writer knows what's going on and in what direction they're going, right? The actions, the requisite consequences will feel correct for the characters and the totality of the work. Now, does that make sense, right? That the consequences, what happens after the fire setting takes place, right? We're going to continue with that metaphor of setting characters on fire, right? That the consequences that and the things that spring forth from that act in the novel will feel like the correct thing for the characters, right? And ultimately, because it's correct for the characters, it will be correct for the totality of the work, the total effect of the work, right? So, Darth Vader killing Obi-Wan in The New Hope is moral. Right now, how is that possible, right? How could that be? In that it is exactly what we would expect from a scoundrel like Darth Vader. That's how it's moral, right? It makes sense for Darth Vader to do what he does. And Obi-Wan allowing himself to be killed by Vader is moral. How's that possible? Because we know it's going to increase his strength, and we understand that Obi-Wan has really more or less completed his fleshly course in the story. Right? Luke is well on his way. The cart's been set in motion. Now, we don't know any of this when it happens, of course, but we trust the storyteller will guide us to the moral outcome, the totality of the story. So in the moment of Obi-Wan's slaying, right, we can maybe only feel anything but pity and anger, sadness, confusion. Why did he lower his lightsaber? Why did he allow Vader to cut him down? We fully expected of Vader, so there's no question there, right? But when we get to the end of the story, it starts to come together, particularly at the end of the movie when Luke can actually, at least on a surface level, communicate with Obi-Wan and see visions of Obi-Wan, right? But that doesn't happen right away. When it happens, initially when it happens, it shakes our value system to the core because the villain's not supposed to win. And that's what it looks like in that first part. So when we're watching that movie, we're watching to see what happens, and we see that Darth Vader strikes down Obi-Wan, we gasp in horror, right? Because yes, it's expected of Darth Vader, but it's not expected for Obi-Wan to just disappear into his clothes the way he does, right? It seems unfair. It strikes us as unjust. It's not unfair, not just yet, right? But at the moment, right, it shakes our values, it questions our values, it questions us to our core because he's not supposed to win. And here we have a situation where the villain appears to triumph over the hero. Now, it helps a little also that Obi-Wan is not the hero of the story. He's the mentor, right? If you think about it in terms of Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, and we know, you know, it's long been understood that George Lucas was following Campbell's hero's journey archetype when he created Star Wars to begin with, right? So it helps a little to know that Obi-Wan is actually the mentor if you look at the hero's journey. He's not the hero of the story. Luke is the hero of the story, right? But that uneasiness that we feel when Vader strikes down Obi-Wan is a process of having our values tested and challenged. No? No? We trusted George Lucas to deliver moral art, and he did. When we get to the end of the movie, right? Which is why that story has spawned, you know, an entire industry of related films, TV shows, fan fiction, all the rest, right? We followed George Lucas on his journey, and he took us there, and it has spawned and inspired many generations since then. Right? But in that moment, right, we're talking about the character setting the other character on fire. In that moment, we've got a dead Obi-Wan, and we don't understand why, and it absolutely challenges our values, right? Tests our values. What do we think is ultimately important? And then when we realize what Obi-Wan is up to in that moment when he lowers his lightsaber and allows himself to be stricken down by Vader, it starts to come more clear to us at the end of the story, right? Now, a common argument you might hear, and I've definitely heard this in my MFA program at Southampton College, a writer would stand up and say, they don't make art for others, right? And Gardner talks a little bit about this. He briefly mentions this for a page or so in chapter two, right? A writer stands up and says, well, I don't make art for others. I don't create my fiction with an audience in mind. They don't think of an audience when they write, and therefore, their morality is irrelevant. and therefore morality in fiction is irrelevant, right? Because if morality in fiction is about what lessons you're sort of imparting onto the audience, but you're not writing with an audience, then this whole conversation is moot, right? Is pointless. But this is nonsense. Straight up nonsense. And so if you're entering into an MFA program and you're going to encounter somebody who comes to you with this information, just sort of smile and nod and know that they don't realize that they're sort of trapped in the house of mirrors and they don't see they're on the other side of the mirror just yet. They will. They'll get there, right? I would find it very difficult to find a sincere artist who has only scorn for humanity and who doesn't create art as a consequence or a manifestation of some degree of love, right? He's doing it out of some motivation for love. Any artist who creates art from a place of scorn or indifference will not be remembered, or will be remembered as moral anyway by way of accident. They'll end up having moral fiction whether they like it or not, because the audience sort of decides upon the morality and the values of the fiction, of the work of art. One might think of Camus' The Stranger and think that Camus, for example, had a kind of this, what Gardner really rails about, the cold, indifferent, absurd, nihilistic view of humanity. You might think Camus possessed that, but the compassion and the human strength to be found in The Stranger is overwhelming, right? And we see it in his neighbor's dog, right? The old man's dog who runs away. And the old man gets excited every time he hears a dog in the neighborhood barking, and then immediately becomes disappointed when he realizes that it's not him. And it's such a simple detail, but, well, absolutely teeming with human love and loss and despair, and something that we can all feel even if we're not dog lovers ourselves, right? That sense of longing and loss when we have lost something in our life that we don't know if we're going to get back, and that little jolt of hope when we think we might have gotten it back, and then ultimately despair when we realize that we haven't, right? And that's the longing and the desire to be found in The Stranger. It is not a nihilistic book. It is not a book without love. In Gardner's view of contemporary culture, and I think some of this still applies today, though not as clear, our culture has a tendency, at least in this time, to fetishize an artist's freakiness or quirky eccentricities, right? Whereas at one time the artist illustrated the sad life of the freak, the outsider. Think of Victor Hugo's Quasimodo, right? They did this as a means to teach us to be better towards those who fall outside of our norms and expectations, right? That's the moral, and that's amoral, right, that you would find in The Hunchback of Notre Dame, right? Quasimodo is sort of an embodiment of that lesson, that we need to be better and treat better those who fall outside of our expectations and our understanding of what human beings should look like. But now we value the artist merely for the quirkiness, right? Where's the hump on the artist's back? What is the quirky, weird, strange thing that the artist is engaged in their private life that we can sort of look at and mull over and maybe even be disgusted by and maybe even reject the artist's work because of it? Although what Gardner's talking about here is more of a celebration of artists for their quirkiness and their eccentricities and the weird things that they might have done in their private lives that, that sort of create this mystique and intrigue around them that isn't really there in their work, right? So we value the artist merely for that quirkiness, the intellectual humpback, right, so to speak, and not her wisdom or how she contributes to maintaining the world of gods and men, right? How is she keeping the world of gods and men in an organization, right? Well, we're not looking at that. We're looking at, you know, what is she doing in her private life, right? And this can sometimes have an added impact on how we treat and view the heroes and villains of our stories, right? So it has that added impact. I started to notice this in films way back when they made Spider-Man 2, the Tobey Maguire film, Who Fights Doc Octopus. Alfred Molina, I believe, is the actor who played Doc Ock. And that was one of the first times where, as a culture, really, we saw a villain painted in a sympathetic light. And I have to say, honestly, it was really brilliant and refreshing, and yet the film still maintained its overarching morality, right? When you get to the end of that film, things go the way they should be, consequentially, regardless of the sympathy we might feel for Doc Octopus, right? In lesser capable hands, the treatment of the villain as just a hero gone wrong can send the work off track, right? And Gardner talks a little about this in Chapter 2. Obviously, this book predates Spider-Man movie, but I was thinking about the Spider-Man 2 movie while I was reading this chapter because it jarred into my head immediately. Like, yeah, you know, I remember that. I could almost trace back the origin of that. And now it seems almost like every one of these superhero stories, these Marvel movies that are being pumped out every year, we are developing constantly sympathy for the villain, sympathy for the villain. They even went back and kind of gave Lex Luthor a villain, a backstory to give us sympathy for him. But that was something that was entirely foreign, at least in films, up until maybe 20 or so years ago. But as Gardner says in the chapter here in Chapter 2, we can't treat with equal value the unique and interesting peccadilloes of Ivar the Boneless, a monster of a human being even among Vikings, and that of King Alfred of England, who faced Arvar down, right? That there is this villain, there is this good that needs to triumph over evil, and Ivar the Boneless certainly was evil, right? Ultimately, you can't really escape that. He talks about snuff films. Snuff films are ultimately immoral. Even if the cinematography and the lighting and the acting is wonderful right up until the actress is murdered, right? Because that's the totality of a snuff film. When you get to the end of a snuff film, is that a real human being dies, right, in those movies. So this is ultimately immoral. Right? Now, this is different from what Plato was talking about. Now, I'm not saying a villain has to only do villainous things. And I'm not saying we should condemn a work of art because it contains villainous things. That's a different story. That's what Gardner's saying. That's sort of the conservative viewpoint, right? To Plato, who was wrong, right? If a playwright showed a good man performing a bad act, the writer's effect was a corruption of the audience's morals. She couldn't be any more wrong about this, right? But according to Plato, and we're starting to see some of this thinking come back into vogue a little bit about the artist who creates art where characters are doing things that are reprehensible, particularly when they're doing something reprehensible to somebody in a marginalized community. You know, that reprehensible thing that the character says or does, right? Reflects poorly on the writer, reflects poorly on the art, and therefore sort of dashes the art on the rocks. This very issue kind of popped up just a couple years ago with a poem called Shawl's Ferry Road by Michael Dickman. It was a poem that was published in Poetry Magazine, and people who read the magazine were highly offended by it. The speaker of the poem is sort of reflecting on the life of their sort of bigoted, racist grandmother, who in these little instances, these little vignettes throughout the poem, encounters in one instance, I remember, encounters a group of Pacific Islanders crossing a street, and she kind of directs the driver to steer towards them and run them over. And there's a certain degree of kind of like a familiarity that a person, particularly, to be honest, white people would probably recognize that type of relative in their own family. I certainly recognize it in my own grandparents. It's like a dark kind of humor, but it makes you wonder in hindsight whether it was really being humorous. In either event, the poem was sort of a long... There was more to the poem than that, and the poem was in a lot of ways, the editor's first instincts about the poem were the correct ones, which was that... You know, you are taking this woman's life in the speaker of the poem is taking the grandmother's life in totality, warts and all, and is sort of including that detail of her life, which can't be ignored. But there's this new kind of idea that it completely trumps anything else that the grandmother might have said or did in her life, and in a lot of sense kind of ruins the poem and the morality of the poem. And so there was this backlash against the poet, and the poem was actually, and against the editor who approved the poem and published it. The editor had to step down. The poem was removed from the archives. The poet received a lot of grief as well, and the poet is Michael Dickman's very sensitive to these kind of issues and sensitive to some of the issues surrounding social justice today. And so, you know, to his own credit, he actually asked that the poem be removed. So it's not a clear-cut case of what maybe people might want to call censorship, but it certainly sent a message across, I think, the poetry world and across the literary world in general that there's this new kind of thinking, or maybe a resurrection of the old Platonic kind of thinking, which is that if you have characters doing something immoral, reprehensible, it reflects on the morality of the writer themselves, that it is an endorsement, right? And the editor who pulled Charles Ferry Road ultimately said that he had not considered or thought about the fact that the poem presented these pieces of this evidence of racism from the grandmother without the poet or the speaker of the poem calling it out, so to speak, for what it was, in an appropriate fashion. And I talked a little bit about that incident in some previous podcasts, but it did remind me of that. It's also reminiscent also of what you might hear for contemporary conservatives who oppose video games or violent cartoons, right? You might hear this a lot of times from conservatives on the other side of the aisle, where people who feel that violence in cartoons leads to these school shootings, right? Violent video games causes alienated youth, right? So Aristotle came along and corrected this notion that Plato had put forward, right? And basically says that, look, it's the total effect of an action that's either moral or immoral, the energeia, as Gardner puts it. It's the actualization of the potential. Well, really, right? It's the actualization of the potential. What does all this wickedness lead to, right? What does the grandmother's racism lead to? What does the speaker's understanding of the grandmother's racism lead to? Does it affirm life? If it does, then it's moral. And here there shouldn't have been any issue, right? Now, excuse me. Now, fairy tales, as we know, change the lives of children. They function as a teaching tool. Gardner says in the book, sympathetic black actors on TV have more power than busing laws, which is a really powerful line, right? Sympathetic black actors on TV have more power than busing laws. Now, here is Gardner screaming into the 21st century, where we are at least seeing some movement in that direction, right? The power of representation, representation's power in art, where representation becomes almost part of the moral when you live in a multicultural society, right? And it has an incredibly powerful ability to teach the right things to the right people when you have that representation taking place, which we probably didn't have during Gardner's time, right? Now, interestingly, from our understanding of morality, we see it manifested in the more common way, our understanding of morality in church or God, right? We could see morality manifested in that way, in a sort of religious, church-oriented way, or we can analyze morality from a humanist perspective, right? That could draw us away from God, but not away from morality. So you really got these sort of two ways of analyzing morality, and that's if you're going to do it from a Judeo-Christian or a religious viewpoint, then you're going to move along and follow morality down that road. But if you look for a more secular way, I mean, a humanist perspective, you still have this thing called morality to deal with. And Gardner gives us three masters who had different approaches in their moral affliction in this chapter. And that was Tolstoy, Homer, and Dante. Right? Now, he talks about the similarities and the differences between these two. Well, in Tolstoy, we see characters manifesting morality in relationship to the Judeo-Christian God. Right? God is the model. He passes his model in physical form down to humankind through Jesus Christ, whose message is best absorbed, in Tolstoy's view, by the peasantry, the salt of the earth of his day. Right? And so that's the process. That's the hierarchy or the ladder, the inverted pyramid. Morality is established by God. manifests itself through his son, Christ, and then on to the peasantry. But even the nobility in Tolstoy's work, in War and Peace, seem to approach this Christian purview of morality in the totality of the decisions that they make in that book. Humility, compassion, forgiveness, the pursuit of peace, even when peace can sometimes be unavoidable, or war can be unavoidable. Those ideas that Tolstoy put forth are more than likely coming from that Judeo-Christian heritage. If you remember, Tolstoy, particularly towards the end of his life, did become pretty devout Christian, right? Now, Homer, you know, thousands of years before Tolstoy, Homer is somewhat of a brethren to Tolstoy, only, you know, and swap out God and Jesus for Zeus and Achilles or Prometheus, right? And the morality of the Iliad are sort of mirrored by the Odyssey. And the thread is similar. Zeus and the gods, they set the standard of moral behavior, and exceptional men or women carry it out on earth, right? So the gods set the standard, and the men carry it out or execute it, and the women carry it out and execute it on earth, right? One difference that Gardner notices is that in Greek morality, oftentimes the men have to mix their heroics with deception and craftiness, right? Which is something that would ordinarily be and is rebuffed by the Judeo-Christian storylines. The Judeo-Christian storylines would have you believe that that a character should do the honest thing no matter what the circumstances, no matter what the consequences are. And the Greeks didn't believe in that so much. The Greeks believed that the ends justified the means more so, right? And so it was not immoral in the purview of Zeus and the pantheon of gods for a man to do something deceptive or even violent in order to achieve a moral end, right? And it wasn't a contradiction in that time period, right? So this begs the question, what is honesty, right? So Christianity would preach that honesty must be adhered to regardless of the circumstances, regardless of the consequences, right? Camus' Mersault and the Stranger is unrelentingly honest, which is why Camus said that Mersault's the only Christ mankind deserves in his lifetime. But in Homer, right, in the pantheon of the Greek gods, deception is a perfectly acceptable means to an end, right? So in either event, in both traditions, the model is there. The gods set the ideal. Mankind executes the ideal through the promotion of its heroes. Now, if you're not comfortable with the religious, God-oriented distribution of morality and moral art, then you've got one other choice, at least in this chapter of Gardner's, right? And that is exemplified by Dante, who was an early humanist, right? So Dante was in a state of despair at the time of his craft in the Divine Comedy. A lot of people may not know that about Dante's life, right? He had gone into politics. He was a politician in Florence. He'd ordered friends to prison and banishment. In one instance, he ordered a friend into prison and a sentence that led to disease and death. It caused the death of one of his friends. He was accused himself of corruption and exiled from Florence later on in his life. And in an attempt to trace back where it all had gone wrong for him, he reflected on the long-lasting love that he held for Beatrice, who was the daughter of a Florentine banker whom he knew. Right? And Beatrice would later become the symbol of Dante's salvation, his path to get out of the inferno, his guide to paradiso. Right? So Dante's Divine Comedy, although it's drenched in Christianity and the God of Abraham, right? His salvation in that story and the moral crux of that of Dante's comedy, the Divine Comedy, is accomplished through another human being. So it was actually a humanistic approach. It's accomplished through the love of Beatrice. Right? That's the humanist approach. God sets the standard, but humans need to look inward to find their path out of hell. And Dante's memory of Beatrice rescues him. So Beatrice is the human manifestation of order in that case. The same order that Thor crafted his hammer to maintain. The same order that Tolstoy believed God sent Christ to exemplify. The same order that Zeus and Poseidon ascribe to, which is why Poseidon eventually submits to Zeus's authority despite being an equal of Zeus. Right? The maintenance of order was more important than pride or power or the acquisition of power. The humanist got somewhat away from God, but order still has to win the day. You still have to deal with this pesky thing, right? So Beatrice becomes order. She keeps men honest, and she keeps Dante honest, right? And brings him back from the depths of hell that he had descended into, right? For Tolstoy, Homer, and Dante, goodness is divine. Good. Okay. The totality of their characters' decisions and actions instruct us toward what is good, but The problem is the sky is unguarded now, right? That doesn't mean we abandon the model and source of what is good, of what affirms life, right? The fact that the sky has become unguarded does not really mean anything in terms of morality and the way forward, right? The Romantic poets looked inward rather than outward. So when the Romantics came along, they started to try to find that sort of the gods of the sky they tried to find within themselves, right? Now, that doesn't mean it didn't have its issues, right? Look at the French Revolution, right? And Gardner talks quite a bit about the French Revolution in this section of the chapter. Right, he says, the optimism of the early Romantics was destined not to endure, at least in Europe, though it was basically right. Already by 1820, and certainly by 1848, after the failure of the French Revolution and the devastation of the Napoleonic Wars, dejection, as in Coleridge's ode, was standard. It was not just kings who caused the trouble. Given power, the middle class, from which Romanticism had sprung, proved almost equally tyrannical, selfish, and dim-witted. An explanation was available in Romantic theory. The imagination, wellspring of compassion, was an innate faculty, but one which required exercise and training. But in the heat of events and in the din of individualist, anti-rational philosophies like Nietzsche's, wherein intuition serves not compassion and understanding, but ferocious self-assertion, the Romantic hero as snarling Superman, the explanation went unheard. As time passed, the Romantic interpretation of how art does its work, the poet as divinity, hero, and singer, has been modified still more. Though a few late survivors of the Romantic Age even now strike grand poses, most contemporaries have abandoned the hopes and ideals of the Romantics, or pretend to have abandoned them. Most contemporary writers are hesitant to speak of truth and beauty, not to mention God, hesitant to speak of the goodness of man or the future of the world, though they read the Scientific and American and are uplifted or depressed by each new revelation about whether the universe is stabilizing or decaying. So art instructs. Right? It's vogue to deny that now or to say that the artist instructs, right? But this isn't so. The artist can be flawed and still instruct. The artist can be corrupt. The artist can be in hell. The same way the artist can be in heaven and not instruct. So this idea is that the focusing on the artist is the wrong place to focus on, right? You're focusing on the trowel. You're focusing on the tool, right? This is division when we find ourselves now in 2022, right? Where it seems more importance is placed on the morality of the artist, right? Michael Dickman, rather than the art itself. So that's something to think about, and that's probably a good place to stop and move to chapter 3, right? Getting the idea of moral art away from conservatism, away from those who would use morality as a cudgel to oppress expression. So we have these two tracks from which we draw morality in fiction, right? In chapter 3, we're going to look at how contemporary artists are getting caught up in moral relativism or guilt or nihilism. Hope you enjoyed this part 2. Come back for next week for the discussion of chapter 3 for the third installment. Thank you for taking the time to listen to this. I'm Matthew McGevna. This is The Ink Drop, and you take care. Like a Hellcat.